Next on RadioSt.Pete.com, Peter's Proffer with Clearwater attorney Peter Tragos. The experienced lawyers at Tragos, Sartes, and Tragos discuss common legal questions, providing insight into the legal process and covering current events as they relate to the legal field.
Welcome back to another episode of Peter's Proffer here in the courtroom of current events. And today we are doing a listener question. It was posted to our Facebook by Aaron, and it focuses on criminal appeals. The question is, could you do a breakdown of the criminal appeals process, such as what are some of the most common claims for appeals, some of the ones that are most successful slash unsuccessful, and why, and what systems are in place to ensure that the courts are not being abused through countless appeals? He also wants to know how these appeals set precedent and how that's used in future cases. So we're going to go through all that. We're going to answer all those questions. Keep an eye out for our Facebook page. We're posting polls. We're posting giveaways. There's some listener questions on there. If you have any questions, you can post them on there. It's Peter's Proffer on Facebook. And then if you want to connect with us on any other social media platform, it's at Tragos Law. So for now, just sit back and enjoy the criminal appeals process. Okay, so today is straight off of a listener question from Facebook, and I have Pete Sartes and my dad in here today to answer these questions because I've never done a criminal appeal. So I don't know any of these answers, so I am going to ask them as if I'm the person asking on Facebook, and we'll see what their answers are, and hopefully we can learn something about criminal appeals. So the first question is, how does the criminal appeals process work?
Well, it starts with when someone is either convicted or pleads guilty to a crime, they're told at that point they have 30 days to appeal. And they have to file a notice of appeal within that time. If they don't file it, it's considered jurisdictional and the appeal is dead forever. Once they file the notice of appeal, then at that point you order the transcript of the trial or the transcript of the hearing, and then briefs are written by each side. First, the defendant writes a brief, then the state writes a brief, then the defendant writes a reply brief.
Okay, so let's dig in a little bit for lay people. Okay. What's a brief?
A brief is the written argument where you tell the court, hey, here's what happened, here's what's wrong, and then the court decides, okay, they either agree with you in writing. In other words, this is the written portion of the appeal. All your arguments, all your issues, all your research is contained in the brief. And then, if the appellate court wants to, they can then order oral argument where you're allowed to appear before the judges and give an oral argument that comports with the brief that you wrote.
And speaking of judges, George is right, it's plural. In Florida, the appellate divisions are normally three judge panels.
Okay, so let's take it piece by piece, okay? So you have to file your notice of appeal, okay, within 30 days. What does that mean? What is a notice of appeal?
It's just a piece of paper. It's a form. You fill in the date of the conviction or the date of the plea. You fill in what you're going to do, what appellate court you're going to. And a lot of people, maybe we should start there, don't realize there are different courts. We have a circuit and county court that try cases.
That's the trial court. That's
the trial court.
We'll say the lowest level, for lack of a better description.
Yeah.
The lowest level is the trial court. Then one up level from that, which is where you appeal to first, is what?
That's the appellate court, either the District Court of Appeals in state or the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in federal. And those are totally different judges. They don't do trials. They only do appeals.
So that means that you have a normal case like, you know, armed robbery. You get a judge, you get a jury. Those judges and those courts are the trial court level, okay, depending on severity, whether it's county or circuit court. Then the level above that is the court of appeals. Those courts are not courts where you have juries and trials and convictions and things like that. All those judges do are read these appellate briefs and have these oral arguments and make these decisions on the appeals.
Right. And they also are the place where you have a right to appeal.
Right.
If you have a trial, a criminal trial, you have a right to one appeal.
An absolute right.
Right. Absolute right to one appeal. After that, if you go to the U.S. Supreme Court
Let's explain it one at a time. So then above the courts of appeal, what is the next level up?
The Supreme Court of Florida or the United States Supreme Court.
Okay, so you can skip the Supreme Court of Florida and go straight to the United States Supreme Court?
No.
So you have. So then the next step up would be the Supreme Court of Florida.
For state appeals.
Right.
For federal appeals, it's the U.S. Supreme Court. It's the next step above the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Okay, so let's say you go from state court, trial court, to the Court of Appeals and you lose, to the Florida Supreme Court and you lose. Can you try to go to the U.S. Supreme Court at that point?
Yes, you can. But all those last two steps you're talking about, you have no right to those last two steps.
Correct. It's special
circumstances. You have to get permission right. from those courts.
Exactly. Right. So you ask those courts if they will hear your appeal.
Right. It's called a writ of certiorari.
Okay, so that's the basic where these appeals go, how the steps go up the chain of command, basically, in the courts. Trial court, Court of Appeals, Supreme Court of Florida. Let's get back now to after you file that notice of appeal, then Pete, how do you put your brief together? What is that exactly in the brief that this Court of Appeals is reading?
What the Court of Appeals is going to review is whatever the lower court did that you have issue with. And in order to put a good brief together, there are some requirements that are set forth in the rules of things that have to be in your brief. You know, even things as simple as like a table of contents. But really what you're going to be setting up for the judge is you're going to be giving them the facts from the transcripts. You're actually going to cite the official transcripts of whatever it is you are fighting. You're going to provide the law that applies to whatever it is you're arguing. And then you're going to have to do an analysis for the court as to why you think you're right.
So what that means is you order the transcript of the trial. So you have the exact questions and answers and the objections and what the judge said in his rulings to those objections. You have that in print. You pull those lines, you put them into your brief. Then you look up other cases that are similar to your case that have the same issue or make the argument that you're making and it came out on your side. You put that case law, meaning the facts that happened in those cases and the judge's rulings that you think are correct and should have been applied to your case, and you synthesize those together, basically, to make your argument.
Those are obviously called precedent, the precedent of the previous case law. The other thing that a lot of people don't understand is you cannot add facts in an appeal. Whatever happened in the trial, whatever testimony happened in the trial, you are stuck with those for the appeal. You can't expand upon those.
For example, in criminal cases a lot, if your client doesn't testify and they, you know, that's their right, their Fifth Amendment right not to testify, you can't then in your brief say, well, the defendant would have testified that he wasn't there that night. You can't make that argument because that evidence did not come into play in that trial. So you can't add those facts to bolster your case. You just can use what's in the transcript in the trial.
Another area
or you can use some pleadings and things that are they're actually in the court record.
Another area that people have a misconception about is sometimes they don't like the way their lawyer tried the case. Well, that's not an appellate issue because that's a whole different rule because that's not something that came out of objections or rulings by the judge during the course of the trial. So there's two different ways people kind of appeal. One is the direct appeal and the other is what's called a 3.850 where you're challenging how your lawyer did.
Ineffective assistance of counsel. Right. So it's for a layperson, it's that your lawyer was not effective in the way that they did it. And we'll get to that because we're going to get to what arguments people make and we can kind of dive back into that further. But so we talked about a brief. Now, there are certain cases that a court will order an oral argument. What is an oral argument?
An oral argument is really nothing more complicated than you actually show up in front of that three-judge panel and they basically fire questions at you or you have an opportunity to clarify whatever it is that you want. Now, in state court, if you ask for it, it's a matter of right. You're going to get an oral argument.
So, and what this basically means is usually the judges will take issue with one of your points. They will ask you questions about it, say, why do you think this applies to that case? I don't think this is anything like that case. Your case is totally different, and you'll have to explain your reasoning. Okay, so that's basically what it is. They'll usually pick whatever point they have a biggest problem with and listen to your oral argument. Not every case gets an oral argument. And also the other thing with oral arguments that are interesting is they're time limited. So you don't have 3 days. Usually it's like 10 or 15 minutes and you can save something for rebuttal where you can kind of make an argument at the end. But a lot of times it's so different than trial courts because it doesn't help you. You're not explaining anything to a jury that doesn't know what's going on. So it doesn't really help you to make an overarching argument to try to tug at the heartstrings of the judge or explain or re-argue your entire brief because they've actually read your brief. they've had law clerks, which are other lawyers, do the research and kind of see if your brief is even correct or makes sense. So there's no point in re-arguing things that you already put in your brief. You're better off arguing whatever point it is that they have an issue with that they're asking you about.
And in most cases, whatever happened in the trial court has a presumption of correctness.
Correct.
So the burden is different. If you go to trial, they have to prove your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But once you're convicted, now the burden is on the defendant to prove that the trial court made mistakes and to prove that to the appellate court. So the presumption now is against you rather than for you.
Right. Okay, so moving into the next part of this listener question, which it was a long, in-depth, very good question, so it's a lot of content for us, but what are the most common claims for appeals in criminal cases? And when we do this, let's talk about whether or not they're usually successful or unsuccessful. And Dad, to start with you, we already mentioned ineffective assistance of counsel. Technically, it's not under the same rule as an appeal, but it is a argument that you make up to the higher court. And so, or do you make it to the higher court, or do you actually make that in the trial court?
Initially, you have to file the motion in the trial court. If the trial court denies it, then it's an appeal of the 3.850. It's not an appeal of your trial.
Right.
It's an appeal of the motion challenging your lawyer's competence.
So that's ineffective assistance of counsel. So is that, have you seen in your experience, is that a, usually you're successful, not successful, or just depends a case-by-case basis?
Unsuccessful about 99% of the time. And frankly, appeals are mostly unsuccessful because right. The presumption is that the trial court did it right.
And you, especially in that case, when you're dealing with ineffective assistance of counsel, a lot of times it's legal strategy, quote unquote, or, you know, your lawyer does have some leeway how to argue a case right. Since they are, in fact, a lawyer, went to law school. And if you as the client disagree, a lot of times, you know, you wanted your lawyer to say, how would you feel if this happened to you, to the jury, which they can't do. So those are the types of things that are always unsuccessful. So, Pete, what are some of the other kind of most common arguments that are made in criminal appeals?
The big ones are evidentiary rulings, meaning how a specific law applies to a specific set of facts and how the court at the trial level ruled on whether or not something is in or something is out. Those are very common. Insufficient evidence to support a conviction is also a very common type of appellate issue.
And almost always unsuccessful.
Yeah, because what you're basically saying is even though there's evidence presented by the state, it was not does not rise to the level of sufficiency to convict me of the charge.
Yet a jury found the person guilty.
Correct.
So, and then I know another one, I don't know how common this is, you guys can tell me, because the one that's in the front of my mind is the one you guys just had recently that was successful, which is why I bring it up, because I don't know if it's usually successful, is what is it? How would you describe this, that the charging document is actually wrong, that they charged then and tried the defendant under?
Well, that's a motion. That's motion practice that's happened outside the trial. For instance, a motion to dismiss based on an insufficient indictment. The charging document is too vague or charged the wrong crime.
Or an old statute.
Yeah,
or
that's a jurisdictional
argument. You got those. Then you've got the constitutional motions, motion to suppress. And I think that it would help if, like a real life example here, the police officers go to arrest somebody. They don't have a warrant. They walk into their backyard. They see him in the garage. They go in there and they arrest him. Well, you challenge that on a motion to suppress, saying that the Fourth Amendment applies and they didn't have a right to go into the backyard and they didn't have a right to go into his garage and arrest him without a warrant. That could be appealed. If you lost that motion, then you'd appeal to Ohio court saying, higher court, the Fourth Amendment applies here.
When do you do that appeal, before or after the trial?
That one is after the trial.
So you go to trial, you win, then it doesn't matter.
That's
but
right.
You go to trial and you lose, then you can go back and say the reason I lost this trial is because the judge incorrectly decided on my motion to suppress.
And that's an interesting point too, between the difference between criminal and civil. In criminal cases, very rarely can the state appeal if you win.
Because double jeopardy.
Right, because of double jeopardy. It's always
a defendant. We did a podcast on that, so if you have questions, go back and listen to
right.
it.
Right,
and to kind of go back for a second, you asked when do you appeal that. The vast majority of what you're going to appeal happens after everything's said and done. There are very few, and they're called interlocutory appeals, meaning appeals that happen during the pendency of the case.
So we've talked about, and that's another distinction I wanted to make, you don't only appeal or have the ability to appeal things that happen in the trial. You can also appeal, like we've mentioned, a prior ruling prior to the trial, or how the judge ruled on, you know, whether or not this witness can come and testify at trial, how the judge ruled on whether this piece of evidence could come into trial, how the judge ruled about, you know, opening statements in the trial, jury selection, every part and parcel of the litigation of the case and where the judge is making rulings. You can appeal any of those things that you think, that you thought were reversible error. So let's talk about that for a second. What is the difference between reversible error, which is something that makes the judge, the appellate court, change what happened at the trial court, versus harmless error?
Just because something in a trial happens and it's wrong does not automatically mean that your case is going to get overturned. And the difference is, and frankly, the words are exactly what it is. Something can be an error, but that error is harmless, meaning in the grand scheme of the entire case, it doesn't change the outcome. Therefore, even though you may be right, you don't win. On the other hand, if it's an issue that has effect on the overall outcome of the trial, meaning the judge applied the wrong law, the judge allowed facts into evidence that shouldn't have been allowed, whatever the case may be, the application is just wrong and it affects the fundamental fairness of the proceedings, that's when you see redress in the courts.
So an example of that could be if the judge lets a witness answer that, you know, the notebook that the murderer was carrying in his left hand when he shot the person was blue, when, you know, they didn't actually see the notebook, that might be harmless error. But if they say, I'm positive it was this guy, when they, you know, first identified somebody else and they didn't allow you to bring in the evidence that they first identified somebody else and left that out, that could be much more important than what color the guy's notebook is. Even though they shouldn't have been allowed to testify what color the notebook is, it didn't change the outcome of the case. So even if the judge makes an incorrect ruling, but it doesn't affect the outcome of a case, the appellate court may say, you know, defense lawyer, you're right on this appeal, but it's a harmless error. It didn't affect the case. Versus the, you know, evidence of, you know, multiple people being identified was important, should have come in, may have affected the outcome of a case, and they're actually going to reverse the ruling.
You know, sometimes the case is, the evidence is just so heavy that one little thing, is like you said, wouldn't make a difference. There's also sometimes where appellate courts here, especially the Second District Court of Appeals, which is our appellate court, they have this thing called PC affirmed, mm-hmm. where they don't even have to tell you why they don't even have to tell you why they're not reversing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which really should be obvious
to you.
Yeah. Makes life hard for you, because if you get a PCA, a per curiam affirmed, you now have no right to appeal to the next level.
Right. And those are usually the, you know, the ones they feel pretty strongly about, the appellate court.
And in our area, the Second District does more PC affirmed than any other district in the state.
Wow.
Yeah, that's why they call it the Second PCA.
instead of DCA. Pete, I was just going to ask you.
Successful versus unsuccessful?
No. Oh, no. So we've gone successful versus unsuccessful. What I was going to ask you is, so to go back to some more common arguments that are made in appeals, I know this is one that we've had sometimes, and sometimes we pull it out if we have a stronger argument, but the litany of errors, basically, that there, it was a lot of little errors, but so many little errors just added up to it.
Right. It's called cumulative effect. Right. I will tell you that normally cumulative effect of errors doesn't work, but there are times where this little thing leads to this little thing, which leads to this little thing, and it grows upon itself and it snowballs.
They're painting such a picture with all these errors that the jury didn't really get to hear the real case.
Right. Or what happens is you come to a point where it's evident to the appellate court that the decisions being made by the trial court are affecting the fundamental fairness of the proceeding. And that's when you'll see a cumulative effect of errors. Now, the one thing that people don't understand, though, is, like you said, you've got the transcripts, you've got what the lawyer said, and what your dad said is correct, because you are only appealing what the judge heard. And that's kind of, people don't understand, a great appeal really stems from a great trial lawyer's work, meaning if you don't have the motions filed, if you don't have the case law in front of the judge, if you didn't express to the trial court why something should or shouldn't be, it makes it far more difficult to appeal that issue successfully.
Right, and that's kind of getting into the weeds, but that's what we call in the legal field protecting the record. You have to make the certain objection. You have to ask the judge to, you know, call, call a mistrial. You've got to do all these things to set up the fact to even protect the right to appeal this issue. But, you know, that's kind of getting into the weeds.
Let me go back to that 3.850. We're talking
about
that.
Which is ineffective assistance of counsel.
If you don't make the objection, then you waive it in most cases. So then you lose the appeal because you didn't make the objection.
Which then can bring up the ineffective
assistance. But then you can complain about your lawyer not making the objection, and that's the 3.850.
Right. Lawyers do this to themselves, basically. Okay. So when we talk about precedent that we're even using in these briefs that we talked about, but where does that precedent come from, and how do appeals have an effect on the precedent and the law that is the quote-unquote case law that we use in these arguments?
All right. Precedent is nothing more than the cases that have come out on a particular topic before you. And we work in a system of common law, meaning that the case law, which are the opinions of the appellate courts, build upon each other. So over the course of time, a law is applied to a set of facts. And then somebody will appeal and say, well, but my set of facts is different than the last guy's. And then the appellate courts will make a determination about how that specific law applies to that specific set of facts.
For a quick example, okay, so DUI, you can't drive a car under the influence of alcohol. Well, what about the first time somebody drove a scooter under the influence of alcohol? Well, they had to decide whether or not a scooter applied under that DUI law, and it did. And then what about a bicycle with no motor? Well, we know that cars, you can get a DUI. We know that scooters can. Now an appellate court has to determine whether or not you can on a bicycle. What about rollerblades? What about running? You know, where do you draw the line? So every time it's something, you know, you tweak a certain set of circumstances, you may have to have an appellate court make that determination. Once it's been determined under those specific facts, now I can use that case law in my, you know, scooter case or in my rollerblading case to show that other courts have already said this, and the appellate courts are very apt to follow the line and agree with the other courts and decisions that have been made before them. But there are times where they disagree and where, you know, two different DCAs disagree in the same state. And just, this is a little bit into the weeds, but the stronger the case law, meaning the higher the court. So if the Supreme Court of the United States said it, you're not going to disagree with it as a district court of appeal. If the Supreme Court of Florida said it, you're probably going to agree with it as a district court of appeal. But if two different district courts of appeal disagree, sometimes they'll be a little more willing to disagree with a different DCA, especially when compared to with a Supreme Court.
Well, one prime example is if your listeners listen to the Kavanaugh hearings. One of the things they ask Kavanaugh is, would you follow Roe versus Wade? Well, that is a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. That is the ruling that established the right to abortion. That is a precedent. That is in writing. And the only people that can overrule a Supreme Court ruling is the Supreme Court. So that's why the senators were so concerned about what Kavanaugh's opinion was about an established precedent, which is Roe versus Wade.
And this is probably a whole other podcast topic, but that's why the U.S. Supreme Court is so important. That's why everybody cares about these Supreme Court justices, just in case people don't understand what the big deal is. When they make a decision, all the courts have to follow it. When they say a statute or the Constitution or something says this, that's what it says. How they interpret it is how now all the other courts basically have to interpret it. Well, that's why it's so important.
As we learned in law school, it's the law of the land when the U.S. Supreme Court says it. It is just as important as a portion of the Constitution.
Okay, so the next part of the question is, are there systems in place to make sure that the criminal courts aren't being abused or clogged with countless appeals that really have no merit?
Well, that's where the per curiam affirmed comes into play. That really is the limiting factor, because the reality is the appellate courts exist to make sure that the lower courts are acting fairly. It's one of the checks and balances in the judicial system. So there really isn't somebody up there going, ah, too many appeals today, let's crank back and let's throw some out. It doesn't work that way.
It's just if it's so bad, or, you know, it was a nice try by the defense lawyer, but, you know, there's a videotape of the lady shooting the guy in the parking lot. You know, this is not, yeah. This appeal is not moving very far.
And I think the definition of the word abused is important. People have a right to appeal. They have a right to make sure that their conviction was a conviction. We don't want innocent people going to prison. We don't want innocent people being electrocuted. We don't want innocent people to have a problem here. I mean, I realized electrocuted.
Yeah, that's right. That's how old you are.
Sparky.
Yeah.
They actually still have Sparky. Yeah. But we don't want that to happen. And in order to ensure that doesn't happen, that's why we have these appeals. I know they're frustrating. I know they're time consuming. But, you know, you want to make sure you did it right.
And let's talk really quick for a second in the same vein. What is the difference and importance of appeals in death penalty cases versus regular criminal cases?
They get priority in the appellate courts. They also go to the state Supreme Court. And they also last an average, from what I understand, the average is 7 years worth of appeals on a death penalty case. It's expensive. It costs the state a lot of money. The Attorney General's office has guys full-time that handle these kinds of appeals. You have to house them separately in the prison system. So it's an expensive, long process. But again, you want to make sure you got it right.
And realize, these appeals for death penalty cases are mandatory. You know, you can't...
And the reasoning is, obviously, you're not... We obviously don't want to convict or put in prison people that are innocent, but to the next level, you obviously don't want to kill somebody that is innocent, and you want to make sure they go through all of their... what do they always call it? That you exhaust all of your appellate
remedies. Remedies,
right.
And that's why they're mandatory, because the courts don't look at it as a frustration on the process to have too many of these. They consider it a frustration to not have these appeals going through.
All right, so to finish up, do you think we've hit enough things that are appealed? I mean, is there any other things that are normally appealed in these cases that would be interesting for somebody to hear that doesn't know just how you appeal cases or what actually you're asking for the court to take a second look at to make sure it was done properly the first time?
One of the things is jury selection, the Batson challenge, where you have a right to select a jury. You have the right to strike jurors that you think aren't going to be fair, but it cannot be based on their race or their sex. And that's happened a lot, where you have to find out, all right, did you just strike minority jurors just because your client is not a minority? Or did you just strike women because your client's not a woman? These are things that are appealed, and those are big issues right now.
So now we've gone through, you know, you can appeal something that happens in jury selection. You can appeal motions to suppress or hearings or evidence coming in or out that you disagree with how the judge ruled.
Yeah, and there's something called a Richardson hearing that you can appeal, meaning that you're appealing whether or not the prosecutor acted fairly. In other words, whether or not the prosecutor may have committed misconduct in procuring a conviction.
Okay, and then what about Brady?
Well, Brady's important because Brady is a much tougher one, because you've got to not only find out that they didn't give you
Brady is. Well, Brady violation.
Well, Brady versus Maryland is a U.S. Supreme Court case that said if the prosecutor knows something that will help you, something that shows your client is innocent, they have to turn it over to you.
Right.
A lot of times it happens that they don't turn it over to you. Problem is, how are you going to know that you weren't turned something, that they didn't get something to you? And the Brady rules now say you have to specifically ask for something. So if you don't ask for it, you don't know it exists, then right. You would have waived it.
Right. But yeah, obviously. So that's another issue. Anything else you can think of? I mean, things said in opening and closing statements that, you know, are not true, or like Pete saying, if it's prosecutorial misconduct of some sort.
Well, they can't violate your client's right to remain silent.
Right.
They can't say in closing argument, ha-ha, he's guilty, because if he was innocent, he would have stood up here and told you about it.
Right. So they say something improper like that or violate the rules that are obvious and the judge doesn't give you a mistrial. I think we've hit most of them. So to finish up, let's talk about what is the end result? So there are multiple options that can happen after you appeal a case. We've talked about, you know, you lose the appeal, and then your options are you can either appeal to a higher court or try to, or if it's just PCA, then, you know, it's over. What are some of the other results that may happen from an appeal?
Well, the most common result is that the appellate court will agree with your exception that you're taking with the trial court and send you back with instructions to the trial court how to play the trial again with changes that they want.
So you mean a new trial?
You're going to do it all over
right.
again.
Right. So one of the successful appellate results is you get granted a new trial, which means they throw out that first trial. And actually, but in that first trial, all of that testimony is still under oath, and you can now use it in the second trial and impeach people with it, and they have to keep their statements consistent. But you have to do the trial over again.
Yeah, it's really open. Doing a second trial is really opening a box of worms, man. It's a Pandora's box for sure.
Okay, and then what else? A box of worms.
Yeah, a can of worms.
Can of worms and Pandora's box. A Pandora's can and a box of worms. Okay, so what is another result that you can get?
Well, the rare result by far.
And the best result.
And the best result is the appellate court takes a look at the facts and say, hey, under these facts, there's no way anybody can be convicted. And they throw the whole case out and you don't go back for a new trial. It's over. It's done. That rarely happens.
Right, but they can do that. They have the authority to say, this guy who was convicted of murder, it's over. Because this, you know, something that was so bad happened that there's no way this guy could ever be convicted based on the evidence that actually exists. And boom, you know, he's gone.
One other area about appellate issues is new sentencing.
Oh, okay, well, okay, because, good. Let's hit those two topics real quick. So another thing you can appeal is the sentence.
Right.
Right? So nothing bad, or not nothing bad, but let's just say, you know, you lose your appeals at the trial, or you don't have anything to appeal that happened in the trial. You don't have anything to appeal that happened in the pre-suit motions or anything like that. What do you do to appeal the sentence?
Well, we have sentencing guidelines in Florida, as they do in the federal courts. And if you violate those guidelines, the judge has certain procedures they have to follow. If they don't follow the procedures, if they, you know, let's say it's a, you're convicted of a crime where the maximum sentence is 5 years, but the judge is really mad and sentences you to 7 years. Well, you can appeal that because he can't give you more than 5 years. So one of the other things that can happen, we say results, is it can be sent back for a resentencing, or the appellate court can just say, this is going to be your sentence.
Okay, so what happens after you go to trial, you lose, let's say you even appeal, you lose that appeal, and then some new evidence comes out, like some other guy admits that he committed the crime, or the smoking gun is found by the cops and they find out it wasn't the guy that got convicted. Do you appeal that now that you have this new evidence, or what is the proper course of action that you can take?
It's similar to the 3.850 with an incompetent attorney. This is a motion under a special rule that you found new evidence and that new evidence will prove you innocent. The most common right now is the DNA evidence. When you find that the DNA proves that somebody is innocent, you have to file a separate motion with the court. And if you're denied at the trial court a new trial or an acquittal, then you appeal that. It's a separate track.
Right, so it's not technically an appeal, but it is a post-conviction motion that you make, meaning after you're convicted. Okay, anything else on appeals that we missed? I think that was pretty exhaustive. So hopefully we answered the listener's question and anybody else that cares about the criminal appellate process. And we'll be back with you guys next time for whatever topic comes our way.
You've been listening to Peter's Proffer with Clearwater attorney Peter Tragos. The experienced lawyers at Tragos, Sartes, and Tragos discuss common legal questions, providing insight into the legal process and covering current events as they relate to the legal field. Find out more at TragosLaw.com.